100 Years' War, the De Guiscolin Period, Problems in Flanders, Part 2. Now, on the 24th January, the day before the aldermen were due to consider his Louis de Mal's demand, a general assembly was called in the Friday Market, which was the largest space in the city. The opponents of the peace came well prepared. As the citizens stood in formation under the banners of their guilds, they read out a declaration to the assembled multitude, urging them that if they wanted their city to survive, they should place all the powers of government in the hands of one man. They had their candidate ready, Philip van Artevelde. Philip was a gang leader associated who had recently begun to take part in the councils of the city. His main claim to fame was that he was the son of Jacob, the famous dictator of Ghent, who had led the city's rebellion against the count's father 40 years before. About half of those present in the Friday Market were opposed to his nomination, but the proposal had the appeal of novelty in a desperate situation, and it began to gather momentum among the crowd. Perceiving this, his opponents sought to diminish the authority of the assembly by walking out of it. This was a mistake, as such decisions usually are. The effect was to leave the field clear for van Artevelde's partisans. Philip himself had been waiting for his moment in the public bathhouse nearby. He was fetched and taken in triumph to the town hall. There he was sworn in as captain of Ghent. An emergency government was set up consisting of the new captain and four councillors of his choice. But the real power lay with van Artevelde himself and with Peter van de Bosch, who became his constant advisor and colleague. They made short work of the treaty. The terms were formally put to the aldermen on the day after van der Artevelde assumed power, and it was rejected. A reign of terror was inaugurated against its authors. Simon Bet was lynched. His colleague Gilbert de Gutier was accused of being in league with the count and killed by Artevelde's own hand. Three men, including the dean of the grain shipper guilds, were thrown in the city prison and then beheaded. Over the following weeks, van Artevelde claimed a large number of other victims who were either killed or forced to flee. Rival politicians whom he wanted out of the way, personal enemies who had crossed him in the past, and a large number of others whose main offense was that they or their forebears had participated in the movement which had deposed and murdered his father back in 1345. Philip van Artevelde's methods were in some respects strikingly similar to his father's, on which they were probably based. He set about creating a new solidarity amongst the inhabitants. Men wore their allegiances on their sleeves, which were inscribed with the motto, God sustain us. The councils of the city were thrown open to the poor. There were tough measures to suppress the endemic private feuds and gang wars of the 14th century Ghent. A succession of populist measures reinforced his power. For the first time, a true siege economy was imposed. Private grain stores of the monasteries and the richer citizens who had farms beyond the walls were requisitioned and sold off at fixed prices. Steeply progressive taxes were levied, which shifted the burden of financing the war on the processors of the great commercial and landed fortunes. Ghent's procurement method became even more aggressive than it had been before. A fleet of shallow draft boats was organized to bring in supplies under heavy guard across the Vier de Achtbanken. Francis Ackerman led a large armed force across the territories of Brabant and the Prince Bishopric of Liège in order to find grain and escort it back to Ghent. Louis de Mal responded by tightening the blockade. His officers broke the bridges over the River Dender, by which the convoys were getting through from Brabant. They hired their own fleet of boats to stop the traffic from the north. The flow of goods was reduced once more to a trickle. Froissart that in the heart, Philip van de Artevelde was an Englishman. There was no doubt that he was right about this. Philip had been named by his father after Edward III's queen, Philippa, who had been his godmother. He had passed his early years in England, where his mother had taken refuge after Jacob's death. But there was more to Philip's loyalty to England than sentiment. He had been in the pay of the English government since 1369, if not earlier, at a substantial rate of 100 marks a year. In the longer term, he knew that his measures would not save the town unless England could be drawn into the Flemish Civil War. So in February of 1382, a month after assuming power, he sent three of his associates to Westminster to open negotiations with the English council. He offered to recognize Richard II as the Count of Flanders and the King of France if the English would supply weapons to the men of Ghent and bring a fleet and army to the Low Country in the summer. Hitherto, the English government had made no attempt to exploit the travails and and Flanders. The region was economically important to England, but it was a distraction from the main objective of dealing with France. It suited the English ministers better to maintain cordial relations with Louis de Mal. When Philip van Artevelde's emissaries reached England, they found Richard II's ministers occupied with plans for the forthcoming peace conference. The problem with all peace initiatives, as John of Gaunt had learned at Bruges, was that without a credible military threat, the ambassadors would have little to bring into the conference chamber. So the Great Council, which approved the arrangements for the conference, also resolved to raise an army of 6,000 men to invade France under the young king himself, in the event that diplomacy failed. Unfortunately, the noblemen gathered at Windsor had no power to grant taxation, and no other proposals for financing this army. The king's ministers had no money, no continental allies other than Portugal. In March of 1382, they were ruefully contemplating the possibility that they would be unable to make war and unable to make peace either. For those at Westminster who were looking for an escape from this predicament, the appearances of Philip van Artevelde's emissaries some days after the Great Council closed was a godsend. It offered the prospect of invading France by the north with Flemish support, in much greater strength than England could have mustered from its own resources. A campaign in the north would also more likely find support in Parliament and among the financiers of the City of London, where the impact of the Flemish Civil War on the wool trade and the Calais staple was already causing concern. Richard II's council took up van Artevelde's initiative, but the council was a coalition of desperate interests and prejudices. Those who wanted to make a success of the peace conferences supported the Flemish proposal for tactical reasons. But over the following weeks, they were displaced by others with larger ends in view. Some of them thought the revolt of Ghent might really supply the means for redressing the strategic balance with France. Some were more interested in spoiling the southern strategy favored by John of Gaunt. As a result, interest in peacemaking began to recede. An assembly of shipbuilders was summoned to advise about the logistical problems of sending a seaborne force to eastern Flanders. Preliminary plans were made to embark the proposed army of 6,000 on 80 large ships and to land them at Antwerp at the mouth of the Scheldt. The expedition was expected rather optimistically to cost about £60,000. Another assembly of merchants and financiers was convened to consider ways of raising this sum without parliamentary taxation. This included representatives of all the mercantile cities of England and the Italian banking houses in London. The financiers thought that the money could be borrowed, but only if Parliament was willing to underwrite the loan with promises of fresh taxes later, if not sooner. So on March the 24th, 1382, the Parliament was summoned to meet once more in hope they would reconsider their previous decision. The opening was fixed for May the 7th. Van Artevelde's and emissaries were told that they would have a firm answer a week after that. The English ambassadors were still in Picardy, putting the final touches on the arrangements for the peace conference. But by the time they returned to Westminster at the end of March, the council had already privately abandoned the policy of settling with France. It was replaced by a policy which was characteristic of the aimlessness and opportunism of English thinking, a program of diplomatic evasion and temporizing extended into the summer, which was designed to gain time while Richard II's ministers argued about whether to intervene in Flanders or Castile, and looked across the channel to see what they could extract from the increasingly confused situation in France. Philip van Artevelde's agents left England on April the 7th, 1382. About a fortnight later, the last hope for peace in Flanders vanished. A conference, at least the third of its kind, had been convened in the cathedral city of Tournai under the auspices of the rulers of Holland, Hainault, Brabant, and Liège, all of whom were concerned about the destabilizing effect of the Civil War. All the major towns of Flanders sent representatives. At Ghent, there were high hopes. The streets and gateways of the towns were crowded with people praying for its success as Philip van Artevelde left for Tournai with the town's delegation. But when it came to the point, Louis de Mal declined to negotiate. He had never won at the conference. He knew by now about negotiations of Philip van Artevelde with the English government, which had been reported to him by spies in London. He was actively recruiting troops for a final trial of strength. He was confident of victory. From the distance, the Chateau of de Mal, Louis announced that his council would declare his wishes in due course. His wishes, when they were eventually made known, were bleak. He would accept the surrender of Ghent, he said, provided that all adult males in the city appeared before him to repent their acts, dressed in their shirt sleeves with bare heads and nooses around their necks. He would decide their fate on that day. The Bailey of Hainault tried to persuade the men of Ghent to submit even to these terms. Philip van der Velde replied that he and his colleagues had no intention and no authority to dispose of the lives of their fellow citizens, and then left. Well, as you can tell, guess what's going to happen? We're now going to have a massive civil war in Flanders in 1382 and 1383. So we're just tearing everything up and making a mess out of Europe. So we'll begin on May the 3rd, 1382, when we get back next time. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, SummaHistorica.com or HistoryAccordingToBob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.